Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 4th of July, these are our main stories. Boeing pledges $100 million to support the families of people killed in its 737 MAX crashes. The European Parliament chooses its new president, and alleged human rights abuses at a smartphone giant subsidiary firm. Also in this podcast, why Amsterdam's mayor wants to hide the prostitutes of the world-famous red light district, and an Arctic explorer tells us how climate change is changing her job.
There's a lot of exploration of places that we used to know that are not like they were 100, 200, 300 years ago.
The 737 MAX was once Boeing's fastest-selling aeroplane, but after crashes in both Indonesia and Ethiopia, which left close to 350 people dead, the jet has been grounded. Now Boeing has said it will spend $100 million to help families of the crash victims. I asked our correspondent Neda Torfik whether this payment, which amounts to less than $300,000 per victim, will do anything to improve Boeing's tarnished image.
Boeing is going to be paying this $100 million over several years to local governments and organizations to try to support those affected. But look, Boeing's CEO said that he hoped this initial investment would give some of the families comfort. They're clearly trying to repair the damage to their reputation. But one of the lawyers who represents some of the families of the victims, Nomi Hussein, said that the payment doesn't come anywhere close to compensating the families what has been taken from them, and that really the families want answers. They want to know whether Boeing did put profit over safety. And so I don't think this is going to really change much for Boeing in that sense.
And there are other legal actions already underway, aren't there?
Yes, this payment is completely separate from the dozens of lawsuits from families of the victims. They are still waiting for more information, in fact, others from the investigations to see if they're going to go ahead with other legal action. But already, again, Boeing is bracing itself for either going into settlement talks for a class action suit or dealing with individual.
The 737 MAX was the fastest selling airplane Boeing had. Just how big an impact has the grounding of the entire fleet had on it?
Well, I think we're still trying to figure that out. I mean, on the one hand, you look at Boeing's stock price, it's still doing incredibly well. Although the last quarter of earnings, they had some of their worst results in years. You know, they've had to ground the planes so they can't deliver the planes to airliners and collect those payments. They've also slowed down the pace of manufacturing those planes, obviously, until they get approval by global regulators to the software update to correct the issue at hand. But longer term, I think investors understand that Boeing could, in fact, make these software changes without being too costly. But then again, there's also the legal consequences. And if airliners are going to be demanding payment back for what has hit their bottom line. So overall, it's still unclear how badly this will affect Boeing, but some signs already that it is affecting their bottom line.
Neda Torfik. The European Parliament has a new president. David Sassoli from Italy was elected on Wednesday. Meanwhile, the German Defence Minister Ursula von der Leyen is hoping MEPs vote her in as the next president of the European Commission after member states nominated her earlier this week. Here's what she's been saying.
I feel very honoured to be nominated as the president of the Commission by the Council. When I heard about it yesterday, I decided that my very first stop will be here at Strasbourg to meet the European Parliament and to go immediately into talks with the parliamentarians, because here in the European Parliament is where the heart of democracy, of the European democracy, is beating.
Adam Fleming has the latest on the EU's leadership picks.
The first thing on the agenda here at the European Parliament in Strasbourg was electing a new president for the Parliament. A slightly misleading word in English, it's more like the chairman or the speaker. And after four candidates and two rounds of voting, it went to the centre-left former Italian journalist David Sassoli. He took the chair. In his acceptance speech, he summoned the founding fathers of the EU and said that everyone should work together and stand up against nationalism. He called for ambitious action on climate change and reform of EU asylum policy, two things the European Parliament has been pushing for a long time. He made a brief reference to Brexit and said that the negotiations should be handled in a reasonable way. Then here in Strasbourg, we received a visit from the German Defence Minister, Ursula von der Leyen. She is the nominee of EU leaders to become the next president of the European Commission. And the reason she is here is because in about 2 weeks' time, MEPs will vote to approve her, and she needs to get a majority. Her first stop was to see MEPs from the centre-right European People's Party, that centre-right parties from across Europe. There was a huge crowd of media there waiting to hear from her. She was bombarded with questions about whether she'd get approved by the Parliament, something about Brexit. She remained tight-lipped, sailed through it, completely serene, completely poised, not ruffled at all by the interest in her. Then she went in and spoke to those MEPs. She'll have other meetings with other political groups later today. They may not go quite as smoothly because the centre-left and the Greens in particular are not particularly happy, either with her as a person and her record back in Germany as defence minister, or because they're not happy about the process by which she was selected, almost plucked from the air as a surprise choice by leaders rather than somebody who put their names forward explicitly for the role. But the big moment for her will be in 2 weeks when MEPs vote to decide whether she should indeed be the next and the first female president of the European Commission.
Adam Fleming. The French subsidiary of the electronics giant Samsung has been placed under judicial investigation, one step short of a formal charge, over allegations that it violated human rights in some of its factories in China, South Korea and Vietnam. Samsung has strongly denied the allegations, telling the BBC it is disputing their validity. The judicial complaint was filed by two non-governmental organisations. Sandra Cossart is the director of one of those organisations called Sherpa. She spoke to the BBC's James Kumarasamy.
For years now, NGOs have been denouncing fundamental right violation by Samsung in various reports, some of them being issued by China Labour Watch, who has been able to go into some factory in China, Korea and Vietnam. And the allegations that were made in these various reports are around the employment of children under the age of 16, abusive working hours, working condition, and accommodation incompatible with human dignity and endangering workers' life.
Just explain why this case is then being brought in France.
We consider that the ethical commitment made by Samsung, whether they call it ethical pledge or a code of conduct, are accessible to the French consumer. Therefore, the French jurisdiction should be competent to handle the case. And the magistrate decided in our favor. They are transnational and other countries. So the law needs to be adapted to this fact. And when something happens abroad, that needs also to be decided before some of the home state's jurisdiction.
Sandra Cossart, the director of Sherpa, speaking to James Kumarasamy. The UNESCO World Heritage Site that includes Amsterdam's Red Light District has seen its atmosphere change over the years. Tourists, sometimes leery groups of young men, often gather to stare and comment on sex workers waiting in the windows. Now, Amsterdam's mayor has announced plans to protect prostitutes, but these new measures could change the red light zone forever. Jonathan Savage reports.
Amsterdam's first female mayor says she wants to make things safer for sex workers, and one of her ideas is to put them out of sight. Femke Halsema says social shifts such as human trafficking and increased tourism are creating dangerous and degrading environments. She's making a number of suggestions in an attempt to cut crime and revive the red light district. The options are closing, moving or cutting the number of brothels, tightening licences for women working behind the windows, or simply ending the practice of window prostitution outright.
They become brothels or closed shops where the women work. You can imagine, for instance, that people will have an app or something where you can look the women up on your telephone, but without seeing them in the windows. And it means that people who are passing cannot laugh at them anymore.
Femke Halsema says there is plenty to appreciate about the history and atmosphere of her city's red light zone, but human rights violations and misbehaviour are too high a price to pay to avoid reform. Foxy Angel, a sex worker and a member of the trade union Proud, agrees that many tourists don't know how to treat prostitutes with respect. However, she fears ending window prostitution could cause problems of its own.
Well, if they close the windows, all the sex workers will go underground. Then they need much more people to regulate that. So, no, I don't think that's going to work. It's going to lead to a lot of more crime and hate against sex workers.
The mayor's four scenarios will be put to locals over the next month. The most popular idea will be voted on by the City Council later this year.
Jonathan Savage. Still to come in this podcast, the organisers of Stockholm Fashion Week scrap the event. And a US city says its parks are overrun by Canada geese. We'll tell you why the proposed solution has ruffled a few feathers. The death last week of a Venezuelan naval officer who had been jailed over an alleged plot to assassinate President Nicolas Maduro sparked outrage among opponents of the embattled leader. Now, details of the officer's autopsy have emerged, and they suggest he was tortured. Candace Peart has more.
Captain Acosta died at a military hospital on Friday. He'd been arrested during a roundup of alleged coup plotters and had made a brief appearance in a military court in a wheelchair where he'd fainted. Documents, which a local newspaper say are the official autopsy, said his body showed signs of having been subjected to extreme force, that is, crushed and starved of oxygen, as well as having suffered severe beatings and electrocution. The Venezuelan government says two National Guards officers have been arrested and charged. Captain Acosta's death sparked outrage, coming as it did days after a visit to Venezuela of the UN Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet.
Candace Peart. A federal judge has temporarily blocked a so-called heartbeat bill banning abortions as early as 6 weeks into a pregnancy in the US state of Ohio. I asked our correspondent Chris Buckler in Washington what this judgment will mean.
Practically, it stops the law from being enforced. Now, if you take a look at this law, it is one of a series of states, around a dozen in the US, that have put in place similar bills. And these bills essentially say that an abortion cannot be carried out once a fetal heartbeat can be detected. Now, we should say that that is a very controversial term. There are many medical professionals who do not like that term being used. But you can detect something which some people claim is a fetal heartbeat as early as 6 weeks into a pregnancy. And this particular bill has been described and called the Heartbeat Protection Act. However, in this case, the district judge has said, as far as he's concerned, that is contrary to law that has been decided in the US Supreme Court. And as a result, he has decided to issue what is known as a preliminary injunction against it. So essentially, it is blocked from this moment in time.
So that means that for the moment anyway, abortions can continue in Ohio, but anti-abortion campaigners are fairly confident that sooner or later, this is an issue that's going to go a lot further.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're going to see this go all the way to the US Supreme Court. And certainly, if you talk to Republican politicians, they will say that in the states where they have control, they are pushing these laws because they want to get a challenge to the existing law as regards abortion inside the United States. You will know of this famous case, Roe versus Wade, which dates back some 45 years. It essentially decided that it was a constitutional right for women to have access to abortion, that they should have that choice. But Republicans feel that that is not the right decision, or I should say many Republicans feel that. And as a result, we've had in these individual state legislators where they've been trying to go to the point of saying we're going to put in place bills which limit or restrict the rights to abortion. And that is specifically with the idea that it will be taken to the US Supreme Court, where potentially Roe versus Wade can be challenged.
Our North America correspondent, Chris Buckler. Twice a year, Fashion Week provides a showcase for the newest clothes from the biggest designers in some of the most stylish cities in the world. But the organisers of the upcoming Stockholm Fashion Week have scrapped the event, saying it would be bad for the environment. Cecilia McCauley reports.
From New York to London, Milan and Madrid, Fashion Week. A near eight-decade-long tradition that started off as parades in Paris is now a must-go-to event in the calendars of fashion fans. But not all cities want to keep up the glitzy tradition. This week, the Swedish Fashion Council announced plans to scrap Stockholm Fashion Week. The biannual event was scheduled to take place at the end of August. I spoke to the Swedish Fashion Council CEO, Jenny Rosen, to find out why.
I think it's really important the fashion industry itself take a lead when it comes to the sustainability issue. All reports today say we can't go on how we work today and that everybody knows this, but no one acts. We need to create new business models and lower the volume production.
They've also been working with other industries to tackle the sustainability problem.
We have been collaborating with the forest industry to get a wider knowledge in how we could help each other for a sustainable future.
The fashion industry is a mass producer. Out of the 100 billion garments made each year, it's estimated only 1% are recycled. But it's not just environmental reasons for cancelling Stockholm's Fashion Week. In a world where haute couture clashes with fast fashion, it's also a matter of keeping up with the digital age. Here's Jenny Rosen again.
Everything is so accessible today, so everybody could see everything in a very short time. You could buy a dress or outfit in a few seconds.
It's yet to see if any other fashion cities will follow in Sweden's footsteps.
Cecilia McCauley with that report. This year marks the 500th anniversary of the first circumnavigation of the globe and the 50th anniversary of the first moon landing. And a collection of modern-day explorers are meeting in Portugal to celebrate those great achievements at the Global Exploration Summit. These intrepid travellers have had a front-row seat to the major changes being experienced by our planet. Anne Daniels has led an all-female team to the North and South Poles. My colleague Razia Iqbal asked her about the environmental degradation caused by climate change.
I have so many emotions if I think about it. Sometimes it's pure anger and upset, and I just think we're ruining the planet. I also think there's a lot of exploration of places that we used to know that are not like they were 100, 200, 300 years ago.
So does that mean then that the role of the explorer has shifted also? Because when you mention climate change having altered the places that we may feel that we are familiar with, what is an explorer now then?
Now, I'm not interested in the first, the best, the last so much. It's about how can I help scientists understand the world? So I've been really lucky working with scientists around the world and NASA and going and looking at ocean acidification, how the chemistry is changing of our oceans. I've been looking at the thickness of the ice cap in the Arctic regions. Everything's changing. So I've been lucky that my skills out there can help scientists, and they tell me the protocols that they want me to get, and I can bring it back and hand it over, and they can do the clever brain work and I can do the brawn and muscular work, if you will.
What made you even think about becoming an explorer? What was the impulse for you?
For me, it was a chance. I saw an advert in a newspaper in 1997 and answered it. And by doing that and going out to these amazing places,
what was
I
the
fell
ad?
In love.
What would what?
The ad? Well, I was a mother at home with very young triplets at the time, and the advert asked for ordinary women to apply to become part of the first all-female team to walk to the North Pole. even though I'd never
And you
seen
thought that is definitely me.
I think it was a moment of madness. I'd never skied. I'd never had a rucksack on my back. And I just thought, wow, this looks good, and applied.
Is it still predominantly a male-dominated world?
Yeah, it really is. I've got two big expeditions next year. I am the only female. They're all male teams apart from me. So it is still a very dominated male environment.
Do they treat you as their equal?
They do. They do. They acknowledge my skills and what I bring to the team. We all have very different things. I'm never going to be equally as strong as the strongest guys, but I have other skills. It's the outside world that sort of looks in and, oh, have you got a token female, and looks down at you. But no, the guys treat you as one. You're all out there in the middle of nowhere, and you're reliant on each other for your life, your emotion, and every need.
Anne Daniels, who's been to both the North and South Poles. A new play, Tree, is set to premiere here in the UK this week, but the two men billed as the show's creators, Idris Elba, star of TV shows The Wire and Luther, and Kwame Kwe-Ama, the director of London's prestigious Young Vic Theatre, have been accused of taking credit for the work of two female playwrights. Both men have denied the allegations. Now, one of the women, Tori Allen Martin, has spoken to the BBC. Charlotte Gallagher has been following the story.
You came of your own free will. You brought Luminol to look for blood traces.
Well, DCI Luther.
Idris Elba and Kwame Kwe-Ama are two of the most powerful men in British entertainment. They're currently at the Manchester International Festival for the premiere of the show Tree, which they say they solely devised and wrote. But two young female writers, Tori Allen Martin and Sarah Henley, have spoken out, saying they created Tree and worked on it for more than 4 years. They say they were pushed off the project and threatened with legal action if they talked publicly about what had happened. Tori Allen Martin says she was so disappointed with how they were treated.
We were just two people so passionate about this production, and we're two people so passionate about this industry and in doing the right thing. And I wish, even if they hadn't done right by us in terms of giving us the credit that we deserved, they could have done right by standing up now and saying, OK, we hear you, we see you.
The producers of Tree deny the claim, saying the original proposal wasn't artistically viable and the show needed to go in a very different direction with a new writer attached. They add that although money was offered to both women, it wasn't an attempt to buy them off, but about reaching a compromise. Tori Allen Martin and Sarah Henley say all they wanted was a conversation and credit for the work they did. They say the case is devastating proof of the way doors are shut on women and on underdogs.
Charlotte Gallagher. Waterfowl may not seem especially threatening to daily life, but Canada geese have become a major nuisance in several American cities. Officials in the state of Colorado have even started killing the birds off, as Peter Goffin reports.
The honk of Canada geese is a familiar sound around lakes, rivers, and city parks across North America and Northern Europe. The lanky birds with their long black necks and distinctive white bands on their black faces are a beloved staple of outdoor life, at least for some people. For others, Canada geese are urban pests who carpet public parks with tons of their droppings and chase angrily after anyone who gets too close. And with a relative lack of predators in cities, their populations have boomed. Denver is home to about 5,000 geese in the summer, but they can be joined by 25,000 more during winter migration. To keep those numbers down, city officials in Denver have begun culling the geese and using them for meat, as one parks executive, Scott Gilmore, explained.
It had gotten to the point where the parks were just almost unenjoyable for a lot of people. So that is why we moved forward with this plan, and they are taking them to a processor where they're processed, and they are donating them to needy families.
Denver is not the first city to cull its Canada geese. Washington, D.C., New York City, and others have killed hundreds of geese in recent years. But animal rights groups like People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals have called the practice cruel and unnecessary. And many people who live near goose-filled parks have said the birds are a valued part of the community, as this Denver resident said.
Supporting underprivileged people is noble, but killing wild geese to feed them sounds ridiculous. But this is a park. People want to be in nature and play. Why kill them?
Denver has said it'll consider more culls in future, and they're legally allowed to kill up to 2,000 per year. But the city has said there are also steps locals can take to make their properties a little less goose-friendly, like replacing short, well-manicured lawns with tall grass, or using plants and rocks to create natural barriers around ponds. It's not about banishing geese altogether, the city says. Rather, like so much in nature, it's about finding balance.
Peter Goffin. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.